Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's give a warm Tulare County welcome for our warm-up speaker, Jody.
Thanks, everybody. My name's Jody, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jody.
Yeah, I just got really warm. Welcome, Texas.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And the new guy. Glad you're here. So, I was thinking about this last week when I was trying to get all my ducks in a row. I spoke at this meeting 22 years and 6 months ago.
Wow.
They never asked me back. I'm just kidding. And on my way over here, I realized that I spoke in February. Creepy. Good creepy, but creepy. Okay, so the sobriety date that I celebrate today is January 24th, 2005. I just celebrated 15 years in a row.
All right.
And if you're somebody like me, it's important to say in a row. The only thing I really knew when I first got here was that you guys were making some kind of sense to me. I understood you, even though I didn't know you. And what you were talking about just fit for me. I couldn't even hardly describe it, but it fit. So I kept coming back no matter what. And I didn't start out as an alcoholic. Not that many alcoholics in my family. There's a few generations back that had a drinking problem here or there, but I didn't really grow up with anybody. My dad, however, had married a woman who was an alcoholic, who found Alcoholics Anonymous, and the truth is that I liked her better drunk than sober. Because when she was drunk, she left us alone. And God bless her heart, she died with 40-some-odd years sober, and I gotta tell you that she never really had anything I wanted. She was sober. Whoopee. You know, I did the regular stuff in high school like everybody else. We saved our money for good beer on the weekends. And I grew up in the 70s, last recreational decade, in my opinion. And we had a lot of fun, and I didn't get in a whole lot of trouble. There were times that I would drink a little bit too much, and I'm pretty much grass's weenie alcoholic. I get drunk. I get sick. I stay sick for a few days. I get better. I don't drink again for a really long time until on that one occasion I'm the girl tugging the toilet bowl at somebody's house party getting into their parents' alcohol. So it wasn't really a big problem for me for a really long time. And what ended up happening for me was that I married into alcoholism. I didn't know that at the time either. There are some great historical alcoholics that I married into, and I didn't really see any of that kind of stuff coming, you know. For a really long time, it was really fun, you know. I learned a whole lot about really nice wines, and we'd get dressed up and go to dinner, and, you know, after a couple of years, we'd be having a bottle of wine or two while we're getting dressed up to go to dinner, to have cocktails and cordials and after-dinner drinks and blah, 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 blah. And there came a day for me, like the book talks about, I'm one of those women that didn't really take a whole long time to fall into the depths of alcoholism. I think probably after about 11 years of marriage, I kept trying to keep up. And I didn't keep up well, you know. The truth is, why am I here? Because I don't drink well. And after a while, because I kept trying to keep up, I ended up crossing that line that we talk about, and I fell into this place where I couldn't not take a drink. And I have to tell you that for a while, there came a time where drinking helped me be bigger and louder. It gave me more courage. It gave me more energy. It gave me a whole lot of things that helped me be somebody else so I could keep going. Until that day where, you know, in the end for me, I'm not a functioning alcoholic. I'm a blackout drinker. I drink alone in my room, in the dark, by myself. And I watch my life pass me by. And I watch my kids go up and down the hall. And I can't do anything with them because I just don't have it in me to get out of my bed anymore. You know, there was this time I was laying in bed one time, and I had this vision of this deep hole down in the dirt. And I remember laying down in that deep hole, and I can still feel the coldness of the dirt on my face. And I remember somehow somebody putting a ladder down into that ditch, into that hole, but I didn't have the energy to climb up out of the ladder and get out of that hole. That's how trapped I was in my alcoholism. You know, some of my great ideas, you know, towards the end as I started drinking beer first thing in the morning, because I'm going to throw up. And I don't have to waste my vodka then. I throw up a couple of beers until I can get my stomach settled, and then I can start sipping on the vodka. I controlled my drinking by buying half pints at all my little liquor stores. But after a while, I couldn't drive my car anymore. My kids started hiding my car keys. They started taking all the change out of the house. Wasn't working for me anymore, and I was trapped. And you know, I was never one of those emergency prayer kind of people. God and I parted ways years ago when my grandmother died, you know, when God took my grandmother. And I remember many times waking up cussing at God because I woke up one more time. I was pissed because I had no purpose left in my life. Alcoholism had taken everything that I was and who I wanted to be. So there finally came that day, you know, where had to go to rehab. And I went. And but what happened to me a year or so before, because I'd had a little bit of this instruction from my stepmom. We lived in Venice at the time, and I used to go to Alateen once in a while. And it was interesting there, because all the kids would just get together and we'd talk about how crappy our alcoholic parents were. That's the only thing I remembered about Alateen. And it was a Thanksgiving, probably 96, and I had just barely made it through Thanksgiving, you know, getting the meal on the table, facing the dinner plate at the table. That happened more than once. And just before that, I had been, one of the runs that I was making was to my local grocery store, which was right across the street that's not there anymore. And there was this guy that used to always come and see, ask me how I was doing. You know, and I thought really he was flirting with me. And at that time, you know, it was nice to have a little attention. And, how you doing? Okay. And I'd leave. And so the next night after Thanksgiving, I knew I needed to go to a meeting. I don't know what possessed me to go to a meeting, but I went over to, Christ Lutheran, where the Friday night meeting is, which has been one of my regular meetings for 23 years. And I walked over there and I thought, yeah, I'm going to sneak in the back door. No one's going to see me. I'm going to get a little AA and go home. And that guy was standing at the front door waiting for me. So, you know, the pressure was off instantly. And that made a whole lot of things easier. But my journey after the rehab, when I first got there, there were these three little guys that came in for a meeting to me. And this one little man said this to me, which changed my entire life. And I still think of it today because it still changes how I think. He said to just consider the possibilities that this could work for you. And that unlocked a door for me. You know, and the rest of my time, it's all been about struggle. It's about trying to fit my 2 cents into your 2 cents and coming up with 10. And so I come into AA and you guys are telling me that I'm powerless, and I totally get that. I come from a place where being powerless was a luxury. You don't get to be powerless. You got to be on top of it and take care of the world and take care of everybody in it. And you guys are telling me I'm powerless over alcohol, and I'm finding some comfort and some peace in that. But when I get home and I'm telling them at home that I'm powerless, I'm getting psychologically and emotionally beat to shit. Because you're not allowed to be powerless. We're not having it. And so I keep doing the best that I can. I'm going to 3 meetings a day, every single day. I'm doing as much service work as I can so I never have to be home. I stay sober for the first 2 years, and then I got a chip from Jesse at the Elano Club. And the very next day, I drank. And my experience was this, and what I learned about myself now is the whole time that I was in AA for that first 8 years, I was just learning how to hold my breath. I could come here and try to do what you guys were doing and do it to the best of my ability, but I was afraid to let it sink in because the rules over here are not the same as the rules over here. And I could go for a really long time until I had to take a breath. And the only way I could take a breath was to take a drink. And then I could have some of that ease and comfort and take a big breath and go on with it. And there came a day after 8 years of not being able to stay sober, no matter what I did, no matter where I went. You know, people often say that, you know, you're thinking about your drink before you take it. You're doing. That was not my experience. I never wanted to take a drink again, but I couldn't not in the two worlds I was living in. So I made a decision one day that I needed to leave home and be somewhere else. I decided to leave home because it was the best for my kids. I decided to leave home because I wasn't sure I would stay alive nor stay sober. Turns out my aunt in Las Vegas called me like 3 weeks after I made that decision. She goes, come to Las Vegas, take care of me for the rest of my life. Okay. It was totally a God shot that day. Totally a God shot. So I went there. And I met some fabulous people at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was able to get back on my feet. I was able to feel my heart and my soul. I was able to find a God of my own understanding that I can absolutely trust today, which I still argue with. And life has been a lot better, you know. I was thinking, coming here and going through all this stuff, I mean, I went through this whole gambit of emotions going over the last 22 years, and like for an hour today, I was pissed because I went through some shit and it was hard and it was horrible. But here's the bottom line for me today is I've walked through a whole lot of darkness like a lot of other people, and I've had a lot of loss, and I've also had a lot of joy and a lot of amazing moments that I would never trade and the bottom line is that through all of that, I've been able to stay sober for the last 15 years in a row. No one is more surprised than me. So if you're new, I want to welcome you here. I didn't think that I would find a God here. My first sponsor gave me her God. She said, trust that I have a God. And I've watched this happen over and over again. I find you get a God. And I find you get a God. And I find you get a God. And I kept coming back until I found my own in these rooms and through the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And today, contrary to my own opinion, I'm absolutely fine. And with that, I'm going to keep coming back. My name is Jody, and I'm an alcoholic.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen. Alrighty, let's give a warm Tulare County welcome for our featured speaker, Richard.
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
Okay, well.
There you go. Perfect.
Perfect. Can you guys hear me? Good. Well, I'm Richard. I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Richard.
And I want to say thank you for coming out tonight on Valentine's Day. That's special. And some of you sacrificed your Valentine's Day to come see me. So I hope I can say something that will help you. I want to say a warm welcome to Chris. Chris, raise your hand. He's got 3 days sober. And Chris, before you leave, get some phone numbers and keep coming back. But I have a poem for you I want to read since you're a newcomer. I wasn't going to read it unless we had a newcomer. It says, welcome to AA, my new friend. If you find yourself in AA or don't want to stay, brother or sister, that's okay. We do ask that you stay for at least one day. You actually might find that you want to stay. Here in AA, we often say, just for today. We will love you if you don't like us, or if you're really shy, we won't judge you even if you're just dry. If you're detoxing and you feel you need a beer, grab some coffee and sit over here. If someone sent you our way, you might find yourself wanting to stay. We welcome you with a handshake and a hug. It's okay if you leave us with a shrug. The desire to quit drinking is all that you need. Keep coming back, we earnestly plead. We love you a lot and we really do care. So do yourself a favor and pull up a chair. Thank you for being here tonight. I'll give this to you after the meeting. You can have that. Okay. What I want to do is look around here, and I think I know almost everybody in this room. And I'm glad you guys are here. Some of the people that... it's one of those weird weeks, like, you know, nobody's asked me to be a speaker for God years, you know, and all of a sudden they asked me to be Wednesday, so then after that Rick asked me to do Friday, so I thought, well, I'll just go to a meeting on Wednesday, and they asked me to chair, and I'm thinking, geez, and I'm thinking, maybe this is like getting close to the end of the line for me or something, you know, it's like, this is really weird, you know. I'm ready to go, though, for whatever that's worth, but I will tell you, I'd like to share my experience, strength, and hope with you by starting out and telling you a little bit about my family. Oh, before I say anything, I want to tell you that I really appreciate Mike and Rick and Bill for doing what you guys do all the time, you know, getting ready for the speaker meeting. I've heard some good speakers here before, and I hope I can at least come up to par. Okay, so anyway, my mom, I'll put it this way. I've heard a lot of alcoholics say I was a black sheep of the family. I was a white sheep. I'll explain that to you. My mother was an alcoholic. My brother that I grew up with was an alcoholic. Those are the two people I grew up with. But the entire family and extended family and all the boyfriends and all the ex-husbands that my wife had were all alcoholics. Okay? So I didn't know alcohol was a problem. My mother left my dad when I was two. I was born in 1947. I'm 72. And I do have 37 years, 3 months, and 25 days sober. Okay. But I should have 40 next month. I got here and went back out and did something that taught me something. And then I came back and then I was teachable. I wasn't teachable the first time I got here. But my mom left my dad, and it's a long story, but I'm trying to make it short. I do have till 9:20, so, you know, get comfortable. What happened was my mom wanted to get away from my alcoholic dad. They're both alcoholics, and she I guess they had cars you could get and drive to California instead of being on the transport. So she got a car, put blankets over the sheets over the back seats, and put the three little kids, myself, who was two, my brother Blaine was three, and Preston was four, and headed to Fresno because my sister was out here. So anyway, make a long story short, she got here. And when she got here, she always told us that our dad was dead. I thought he was dead. Until I got a phone call from him when I was 29 years old, and I was practicing law in Florida, Tampa, Florida. I was a licensed attorney in Florida, and I get a phone call, and he said, "This is your dad." I'm going, "You got the wrong number." He said, "No, I just talked to your mom in Fresno." So he was my dad, and after all those years, I guess she just gave up, you know, and told him. So anyway, I'm living with my mom and brother, because my one brother, Preston, died at the age of 8, and I was 6, and Blaine was 7. So I just grew up with the three of them. And my mom drank all the time, and she liked alcoholic men. So everybody drank. I didn't know that everybody didn't drink. I didn't know that. And one of the things that I had to realize as I get to school, my family was different. You know, they all had kids and brothers and sisters, and people didn't drink. And because I wasn't born Richard W., by the way. I had a couple of names because I just took names of stepfathers, you know. But what my mom did was put me in Catholic school, so that my dad wouldn't find me. So I went to St. Helens, St. John's, St. Teresa's, a whole bunch of schools. Went to 5 high schools, 3 of them Catholic high schools, San Joaquin Memorial, Garces, St. Pius X Catholic High School in New Mexico. So we kept moving around. I have moved or changed residences in my short 72 years 120 times. That's a lot, huh? And I've been married 5 times. And my wonderful wife, Maria, here, is the only woman I've been married to that's, quote, a normie, a temperate drinker. Never been drunk in her life. She can have a glass of wine and nurture it for a couple hours if she has to. Going out with friends. So anyway, I'm with my mom and my brother, and things got crazier every single year. But I will tell you something. I found something by going to Catholic school. I found God. I really did. I got nothing from home. My mother had a mental problem. She was put in an institution. She grew up in Oklahoma, Thomas, Oklahoma, and she was put in an institution at the age of 15 in Enid, Oklahoma. Well, she got out. She got pregnant, ran off with my sister's dad. My mother had 3 children, none for 9 years and 3 more. So she ran off, and what happened was she was doing this geographic that we find out we come in here, and I continued that. That's why I moved around so much. But I got nothing from home from my mother. She always told me I was an accident. If you, you know, if you didn't plan a child, it's better to tell them you were a surprise, not an accident. Accident is very negative. And she would say things like, when I die, you're not getting anything. I'm 10 years old. You know? What did I do to you? And then she'd get drunk and jumping up and down on the couch, all fours, snot running out of her nose, saying, why do you crucify me? That's a strange, you know, environment to be raised in. And later on, I found out when she had a boyfriend or a husband, I wasn't the object, you know what I mean? I didn't get blamed, so I liked it if she had a boyfriend. But anyway, I'll tell you what the Catholic schools did for me, particularly the nuns, and then I went to some public schools too. What they did is they gave me the love that I needed. I guess they knew about my mom, no dad, blah, blah. And they would love me. They would tell me I did good. I did everything I could to be a good student. I got, you know, stars up on the board for being, you know, A in spelling and good attendance. And if anybody got ahead of me, I'd go say, what can I do to get another star? So I was working for stars. I got my self-esteem from approval of others. Now that's a pattern I picked up the rest of my life. So as long as a teacher liked me, I was good. As long as the teacher liked me, I was good. So what I did was I kept going to school. I thought that my mother, I didn't see she had an alcohol problem. I thought it was lack of education. She didn't finish school. She left school in Oklahoma and took off when she was 15, you know, because she got pregnant. And so what I did was I thought if I just get enough education, and I was always told I was poor, we couldn't buy anything that was expensive. They didn't have generic back then, but we could buy cornflakes, shredded wheat, bologna, hot dogs, peanut butter and jelly. That's what I grew up on. My mom was gone a lot. A lot. Either she was working or drinking or both. And what happened was I kind of was just raised by myself. And I used to have little things help me cope. I could go out in the backyard and play with my little army guys or my cowboy Indian guys. I grew up in the backyard. I really truly did. I couldn't even come in the house to go to the bathroom. I had to go pee on this tree, you know, wherever we lived. And then I could come in. If I had to do number two, I'd knock on the door and let me in. She used to go out to bars, and we'd sit in a car with the windows down in the shade while she's drinking in there. And we had a mason jar we could pee in. And, you know, I mean, that's where I grew up. So what happened, school was extremely important to me. So I kept doing really well. And I found a God that loved me. I'm going to talk about God tonight. If you don't like it, just say Mother Nature works for you, you know, or your group or whatever. But I found a God that really, truly loved me, you know. And I remember those nuns telling me, Jesus loves me, and I will make Mary cry if I sin. You know, so I tried not to do that. And I was going to be, my thing was, this is before I discovered girls. I decided that I would be a priest. Now, if you won't get good grades in school, especially Catholic school, tell me you want to be a priest. They'll give you extra attention. When I was in eighth grade, I graduated eighth grade in St. Teresa's, I stayed after school every single day. Because if I didn't get the lesson, Sister Anne Gertrude kept me every single day after school. I'm not kidding you. My mother said, why are you always staying after school? What's going on there? Well, I needed to learn the lesson. By the time I got out of eighth grade, high school was a breeze. I'm not kidding you. I had really good skills. So I went to these five high schools, got good grades all through the high schools. Every time I'd get used to get friends and all that, boop, we'd move again. But the thing I'm leading up to, what my mother was doing the whole time, is getting worse in her drinking. Now my sister, who was born in 1931, and then there's a little girl that died, and then I had a brother born in 35, no kids for 9 years, and then the three youngest ones. And so my sister got out of home as she was a teenager. The other little girl died when she was like 3-4 years old. My brother took off when he was a teenager. And my other brother died, and Blaine took off when he was a teenager. And I'm the only one that stayed, but I got kicked out October of my senior year because my mother, you know, she had enough of kids and I was on my own. And I worked my way through high school. got a job at a gas station. I've always worked since 12 years old, paper route, pulling weeds, all that stuff. I worked my way through high school, worked my way through junior college, went to San Jose State, went to Fresno State, graduated, worked for the probation department in Bakersfield for 3 years, saved money, went to University of Arkansas, graduated law school, went to Las Vegas, I was going to practice law in Vegas. It was just, it wasn't my cup of tea, you know, it was just too fast. And I ended up moving to Florida, passing the bar exam, and I practiced law for a little while there. But back to my mom for a minute. She always got a place where she could drink. She had a little place called Dale's Cafe, across from Hall's Drive-In on Highway 99 and Church Avenue. And they, you know, she served beer. So it was like a beer bar, but they also cooked, you know, it's called Dale's Cafe. It was a little dump. Truck drivers went there. My mother liked truck drivers, and she liked construction workers, you know, those kind of guys, blue-collar workers. And when my grandmother died, because I never met my grandmother, my mother ran away from home at 15. I met my grandmother until she had cancer, and she came to Fresno and asked my mother to take care of her. I was in seventh grade. Because she had cancer, didn't have cures back in when I was in seventh grade much for what she had. And so she lived with us for, I don't know, 6 months, and then she died. And my mother inherited a couple of houses back in Oklahoma. So she went back, sold the houses, came back, and bought that Dale's Cafe. Well, she met a truck driver. Well, we were in Fresno. So we moved to Albuquerque. I went to two high schools my freshman year. San Joaquin Memorial and Bullard High. We moved to Albuquerque because that's where the truck driver lived, and he was married. So we stayed there for a whole year, and I guess my mom had thought he was going to leave his wife, and he didn't. So back to Fresno, then back down to Bakersfield to go to Garces High School. And then my brother left. He was a year ahead of me in school. He left, and I ended up going to East High, and I graduated in 1965. But the whole time, my mom had something to do with alcohol. When she moved to Bakersfield, the reason we moved to Bakersfield is she had bought a bar called the Sportsman Den. And it was a house that they built a bar on the front. And you could go, it had a big bar, and you go around the back, open the door, and walk into my bedroom. Now, this is not your typical high school kid. I know a lot of people say, I started drinking junior high and all that. I didn't. This is my first drunk was like my, after I did 2 years of college. So I was a real late bloomer. And I drank for 10 years periodically, and only the last 5 years I really drank heavy. But back to Bakersfield, I found out in that time that my brother was starting to have problems. He ended up being schizophrenic and drinking. But what he was doing, when he was a senior in high school and I was a junior, he was going out in the bar, and these 25-year-old girls. My brother looked like Ricky Nelson. I'm not kidding you. He was a pretty boy in the family. I was the geek. And so what he did was these girls would take him out and get him drunk and party and all that. He had a 57 Chevy. I had a Cushman Eagle. You know? All right. So anyway, he ended up he'd come home drunk as could be. This was a school night too. And I'd go out and I'd pick him up. We had bunk beds and I'd pick them up and put them up on top. And my mother said to me one time, at least one of my kids is normal. And she wasn't talking about me, she was talking about him. Do you see what I'm saying? So, I mean, I was screwed, you know. But I'll tell you what, I kept going to school because I did get all that. My sister, I just want to throw this in there, my sister had a heck of a drinking deal. You guys heard of Palm and Shaw in Fresno? She had a liquor store with her husband, DeLuca's Liquor. He's dead now. He burnt the place down and moved up the street and got DeLuca's Liquor and Sporting Goods Store. Later on, he opened up a bar at the corner of Shaw and Close called The Back Door Topless Dancers. Yeah. They were exciting drinkers and alcoholics, you know. And later on, I kind of followed that path. I'll get there, I think, pretty quick. But anyway, that's the way I grew up. But I do know one thing. I knew that God loved me. And I prayed. I went to Mass every day. I went to confession on the weekends. I would have been a priest. Father Eggert, when my mother died, remember I said she wasn't going to give me anything? She gave that house to Father Eggert. Father Eggert was a priest in New Mexico. He died last year. He was born in 1930. And he became a Monsignor, but he was head of St. Pius at the Dean of Boys. Later on, the head of the seminary. I went to the seminary and visited it. But I knew by that time I couldn't be a priest. Now, a priest could get married. I would have become a priest. I really would have. But I said, I don't think so. And, you know, this time I'm thinking about girls. I don't know anything about girls, but I thought about them a lot. So that kept me from becoming a priest. If I'd have been an Episcopalian or something, I probably would have got married and had, you know, been a minister or something. But I will tell you that all that moving around confused me, but I just thought I was going to try to figure out why I started having problems in high school. And it's called cognitive dissonance, where I was trying to seek earthly pleasures, but I didn't want to pay the consequences. So I studied, and my BA degree is in social science. I started studying with an emphasis in sociology and anthropology. I was looking for a God of my understanding. The God I wanted was the same one that Solomon had. Do you know why? 700 wives and 300 concubines and the richest man in the world. That's who I wanted to be. I thought maybe I should be Jewish. But then I found out they have 613 different commandments. Not just the 10, but another whole bunch of them that they have to follow. In all my confusion, what happened was this girl, who I barely knew, seduced me. And I started drinking. All of a sudden, I put all these questions I had on hold. You know, I didn't leave God. I just kind of put him in the background. And I had a lot of fun. Alcohol was my God. It really was. Alcohol did everything for me, and I had no problem with my conscience. I could do anything and everything, and it was really, really good. Little did I know it was going to turn on me someday. And when it turned on me really, really bad. What happened was, after I was practicing law, I had an opportunity to go up to Sacramento with some multimillionaires and build some houses, and I did. Now, if you read the big book about Bill W., he had said he had arrived in 1929. That was before the stock market crash, right? I had arrived. I mean, really arrived. I'll subscribe it to you. In 1979, I owned 49% of a construction company. We were doing the streets and building the houses. And that year alone, I made $180,000. This is a lot of money back then. It's a lot of money right now. But by the end of the year, things really came down. First of all, the night I met my second wife, I got my first DUI. That should have been a sign there, right? But that was no big deal because really it wasn't my fault. The cops would hang out this bar that I drank at and wait for you to leave. Everybody in the damn bar would have had at least 3 or 4 or 27 drinks, you know. And so when the cop pulled me over, I thought, that's unfair. Well, you know, life's unfair, right? But I just missed it. The second DUI in 79 was way worse. I remember downtown Sacramento, and next thing I know, I end up in jail. And I was kind of arguing with this guy, and I thought, God, what did I do, you know? I had no idea why I was in jail. Evidently, some parked cars hit me, 5 of them. And the insurance guy said, what happened? I said, I honestly don't know. And so he got the police report, told me that I hit 5 parked cars and all that. Did a lot of damage. But anyway, what happened after that, after those parked cars, is I had to go to 2 weekends in jail and nothing about AA. I had to go to drunk driving class. But in drunk driving class, I met this tall guy about my age, a black man named Wally. And he said to me one day, hey, you want to go to AA with me? Well, the lady that did the drunk driving class, she didn't talk anything about driving. She talked about AA. So I said, okay, whatever. I just went to see what it was like. And when I went there, I kind of hit the jackpot because immediately I knew I belonged there. And not only that, they had pretty girls there. And I was still young. I was 32 and single by this time. Hit the jackpot because I didn't go somewhere but they meet girls other than going to the bars. Well, I stayed sober about a year. Did I work the steps? Yeah, I thought I did, but not, you know. You talk about half measures. I did like 1/3 measures, maybe 1/4, maybe not even any measures. But I ended up, things got worse, really worse. The wife, we got divorced, and here's, instead of the stock market crashing, we built houses, we could sell them like this, custom houses, at 8 or 9%. And overnight, those of you that are my age or thereabouts, it went up to 17.5%. So I had 23 houses I couldn't sell, and we had borrowed a lot of money to build this subdivision. 1.2 from San Diego Home Federal Savings alone, altogether about 1.8. We can't sell anything. My business partner, who's dead now, the oldest one, there's three of them, he said to the lady, she said, you know, the interest rates are coming up overnight really quick. You need to lock in your loans for 1%. We're locking your loan at 9%. We could have sold those houses like this. He was a multimillionaire and very cocky and arrogant, like I was too. And he said, we don't need to lock them in. Our houses sell. And lo and behold, by the time we had the house, there was about being half built. We put 17 slabs at one in one day. We had a cruise out there just going like you wouldn't believe it. But what happened was we couldn't sell the houses till they were finished. By the time they were finished, we couldn't sell them at all. Well, it didn't really hurt my business partners, multimillionaires, income tax averaging over a five-year period of time. They needed a write-off anyway. So what was a write-off to them was devastation for me. I ended up going bankrupt. Okay, so now what am I going to do for money? I have zero money. Well, I had a friend with benefits named Julie. And what Julie and I came up with, another alcoholic, we're going to borrow money. Check this out for an alcoholic. Buy a bar. She could run the bar. She was real good, you know, had that personality to run a bar. And I would just take care of the business, you know. So we go to the bank. A guy named David, downtown Sacramento, at a bank. Says, this is what we want to do. I still, on paper, looked like I had a lot because I had all these houses. Could sell them, but still, you know, still owned them till they went under. And he says, okay, I'll lend you the money. But I got a better idea. There's this oil company. And what this oil company is taking investors, and they're going to build, like, I think it was 10 or 12 wells. And it was almost a guaranteed thing because they were drilling where other wells were. And we would just, like, overnight get all the money back. And, you know, this was a dream come true. Well, so we got the loans. I even flew back to Oklahoma, checked it out, saw the rigs. Looks good. Julie and I said, let's do it. As it turns out, it was a scam. Now, I wasn't the only one. There's probably 30 guys that this banker loaned money to buy stuff. Well, you know, when all of a sudden nobody's paying, the FBI gets in there. So Julie calls me one night and says, hey, David called me. The FBI is investigating the bank, and we might be in trouble. Well, she got drunk. And she called me, and I said, I had to go somewhere, and I said, I'll call you back. I said, call me at 10 when I get home. And she put a shotgun in her mouth and put her head off. And that was it for me. I went to her funeral. I took off for parts unknown, took my big book, threw it in the dumpster, and I drank the way I wanted to. Because what alcohol told me was this. You know you're an alcoholic. But here's the reason you can't handle your alcohol. You're trying to live this decent life, you know, attorney, whatever, you know, businessman, whatever. And yet when I drank with these guys down here in the real seedy beer bars. And, you know, if you just forget trying to be this person that where people will like you and just drink like those bikers do, you'll be all right. Well, I did that. But it did something for me. I don't know anybody that shared the same story. I drank the way I really wanted to. No rules, no nothing. My license, got rid of that, got rid of everything, took off in the car, just a little bit of stuff in the trunk. Went back to Florida, went up to Georgia, flew back to Florida. There's a couple girls I knew from before. Moved in with them, no ID, nothing. If I got stopped by a cop, I lost my ID. My name was Blaine Walker. That's my brother. I knew his birth date and everything. He didn't have any felonies on him. So my point was, I got to drink with no reservations whatsoever, drinking nonstop. Of course, I hung out in those bars where you can meet the girls, you know, like the topless dancers and stuff. And this one took a liking to me. We took off, went to Houston. And in the meantime, I'd bought a van where we could sleep in it. And we rolled the van drunk, you know, and tore it all up in the middle of Texas somewhere. And I had a whole bunch of guns and a little bit of cash. And they towed the truck, the the van to the junkyard, and the next morning, I said, you guys can have the van. You know, they use it for scrap metal, whatever. And I gave them some guns I had and some cash, and we got a 240Z, and that was home. I went to San Diego, and then went back to Texas, and I went to Florida. Craziness. But I got the drink the way I wanted to. And here's what happened. I ended up in South Carolina, of all places. Never been there before. In Columbia, across the street from an insane asylum. And just a moment of clarity, I thought, you know, you're worse than your mother. You're worse than your brother. And my whole life, I thought I was better than them. But God brought, you know, God let me get to the very bottom by letting me do what I want, you know, the way I wanted to drink. So, I called David the banker. He sent me some money. I flew home. This was in August of 82. And I stayed with him. No other place to go. I had nothing. The problem is I couldn't stay sober. I'd get drunk every day, three times a day. Just stay drunk. I did go for a job interview once. I barely remember it. Because the job interview was at 10 o'clock. And I started drinking in the morning. By 10 o'clock, I went down there. I remember being there, and that's about it. They never called me back. And what happened was, this time I was teachable, but I still could not quit drinking from July until October. Now, Julie's dead, right? So the ex-wife wants me back again. So we go up to Reno. We stay drunk for 3 days in October. I come back, and another moment of clarity. You need help. So what I did was I called Progress House in Coloma outside of Sacramento, where John Marshall discovered gold, started Gold Rush. And a guy named Bo ran that, Bo for Morris. And what he did was he said, okay, you can come up here. So I did. I went up there, and he said, I said, I'll stay for 30 days. He said, no, you won't. It's a 90-day program. You stay 90 days or don't even, you know, don't stay. So I said, okay. I stayed there 5 months. But here's what happened. I, for the first time, became teachable. Now, not instantly, because what happened was, What happened was, Scotty, one of the counselors, put his finger right on my face like he's going to poke me in the nose, and said, you're not going to make it. And that really hurt my feelings, because I went all the way up there and turned myself in. I wasn't ordered to go. So, I left the real important part out. Before I did that, in July, I went down and talked to the bank. And they asked me 1,000 questions. And I told them everything. With David's blessings, just tell them, babe, you know, Richard, just tell them what happened. And then I said, is the FBI looking for me? They said, oh, yes. I said, do you know the agent's name? Yes. So I went down and I talked to the FBI. I told them everything. Did a fourth step with the FBI. That loans that we got was a violation of 18 U.S. Code Section 1014. Punishable by a $1 million fine and or 30 years in federal prison. That was bad. So I thought for sure I was going to go. So I go to the recovery house. Scotty tells me I'm not going to make it. And I said, why do you say that? And this is where the turning point came for me. He says, because you're still trying to figure out what you're going to do by the IRS, I owed them $30,000. What are you going to do about federal prison? What are you going to do when you get, now this is, you know, I'm not going to spend 30 years. I'm probably going to get 10, maybe 5, but, you know, it depends on my attitude with the judge and all that. But I knew I was going to go to prison, and I also knew that I couldn't get a job afterwards, go back to working for minimum wage. So he said, Richard, you don't trust God. Now, that's the key thing I want to teach you tonight. You can't trust God if you don't think that He loves you. And that was my turning point. And I said, what do you want me to do? You say I don't trust God. He said, okay, why don't you trust me, or I will trust God for you, and you take... I don't forget exactly how he said it, but basically trust him instead of God until I could trust God's what he's telling me. So I said, okay, I will. And I became teachable. And I learned I was unlike a lot of the people in that recovery house. There's 30 guys. And what I did was I took long walks after we had our, and everybody else was playing cards, you know, smoking cigarettes and doing all that stuff. And I'd take long walks and pray and meditate and ask God, what am I going to do? And I'm trusting Him. And anyway, after 5 months instead of 3 months, I got out of there. And I was able to stay sober because I found a God. While I was on those walks, God revealed some things to me. Richard, you had 37 major events. We had to do a thing we filled out for the house. 37 major events in that 8 months that you drank. You're a chronic alcoholic. People don't have that much stuff in two lifetimes. You need help, and you need to rely on God because you ain't going to make it. And I learned about Dr. Silkworth that, you know, that we can't make it without a power greater than ourselves. We're doomed. You know, that there's no hope for an alcoholic of our type. But if we find a God that we can turn our will and our life over to, then we can stay sober. I picked up on that because I needed that. And let me tell you what. I've always had dogs in my life. Back when I was living in that bar in Bakersfield, I had a little half-pug, half-chihuahua named Penny. And while they're all drinking out in that bar, I was going to sleep at 8 o'clock at night and petting that dog. And that dog loved me. I know my mother didn't love me. She was incapable. A long time forgave her because she's a sick person, a sick alcoholic person with a mental problem. My brother was schizophrenic and also alcoholic. They were in, both of them knew about AA. My brother went to AA. I took my mother to my first AA, and they just didn't want to stay. That's why in that little poem I said, stay just for today. Learn about how to stay sober. It's worth it. But anyway, coming back to the recovery house, there was, you know, I felt the presence of God in the, and I saw foxes and I saw animals, and it was like it was a Mother Nature kind of a thing, but I could feel the presence of God. And God says, I love you just as much as that dog loves you. In fact, way more. It's just a taste of my love. And I held on to that. Because I knew that dog loved me. And I knew those teachers loved me. And that's what I could trust, is a loving God. Not a God that was going to punish me for having natural desires, you know, seeing, you know, being lustful and all that stuff, which every adolescent is. I don't know about everybody, but I was. But, you know, the point was I found a God. And that's what kept me sober. Now, when I got out of that recovery house at 5 months, I went down and I worked for a while into my first AA birthday in Fresno Fellowship. And what's ironic about that, I also went to work for my ex-business partners because I had a company in Fresno. And you know what I did? I was the custodian that cleaned this office building they had for $225 a month. That was in 1979. I was making $180,000. I kind of went downhill, huh? But you know what I did when I was in that cleaning those offices at night? I went out one night, and I'll tell you, here's what's ironic about it. The Fresno Fellowship today is in the 2500 block of Shaw. And one of those buildings, I think the one that the Fresno Fellowship is in now, because when I went to Fresno Fellowship, it was another place, was the office that I used to clean. But back in 83, when I was cleaning those, I walked out, and I looked and I saw the sunset. I had no idea what was going to happen to me. I had no money to speak of. My rent for this little studio apartment was $235, so I had to figure out other little jobs to pay the rent and have something to eat. And I had no car for a year. I had a bicycle, and I've had 30 brand new cars. I think I've had eight new Mercedes in sobriety. I'm back to Fords now. But my point is that I had nothing, and I was happy. So, and you see what I thought? I thought my mother was unhappy. I didn't know she's alcoholic. I thought if I just make enough money and get enough stuff, I'd be happy and my life would be good. And I went full circle on that to where I made a lot of money, lost it all, had nothing, and was happy. Go back to what happened with the FBI. I ended up going to court. I was about 14 months sober. So now it's December of 83. And I go in front of Judge Schwartz in the Eastern District, U.S. District Court, District Court in Sacramento. And I go up, and he read the charges to me and said, how do you plead? I really did surrender. I said, I give up to myself. And I said, I plead guilty. He says, "Mr. Walker, who's your attorney?" I said, "I don't have one." He looks at me and I said, "Your Honor, I practice law in Florida, and I'm a member of the federal courts in Florida, and I know my rights, and I want to plead guilty." He said, "I'm not going to accept your plea, Mr. Walker. I know your attorney. I got your case here." He said, "Here's what I'm going to do. I want you to go over there and talk to this federal public defender, and what we're going to do is have you come back." So I went over to talk to her and came back maybe a couple weeks later. He said, "Okay, Mr. Walker, here's what we're going to do. We're going to put you on something." I read the letter on Wednesday. I'm just going to tell you what it said because it takes too long to, you know, find it. He says, "I'm going to put you on what's called deferred entry judgment." Now, in this letter and that I have, I'll tell you how I got that letter. But anyway, he said, "I'm going to put you on federal supervision. If you stay out of trouble for 5 years, I will dismiss the charges. You have no record whatsoever." I said, "Wow." Now, later on, I wanted to get reinstated to the Florida Bar. Not because I did anything, because they didn't know about anything, but because I didn't pay my dues. But I was going to tell them what happened. So I asked him to write a letter and explain what happened. And he wrote that letter, and on Wednesday night over at the other group, I read the letter. But what he did is he told the Florida Bar, he said, "You know, I've done arraignments for 7.5 years, every Thursday, and many, many times I've given probation. 3 times I've only given deferred entry judgment. And Mr. Walker did so well maintaining his sobriety and becoming a productive member and all that kind of stuff." He said, "On the recommendation of the probation officer, I dismissed all the charges after 2.5 years. Okay? So my first year sober, I got a chip at the Fresno Fellowship. The second year, I was working for Jack in a Box. They transferred me down to Porterville on my second year birthday, exact date, October 20th, 84. And I got my second year chip there. So I came to this county. Now, what's ironic about that, I still got about 5 minutes, right? Okay. Is that, what's ironic about that is when I was 19 years old going to San Jose State, I would drive some for Mission Linen Supply, some dirty clothes down. A guy come up from Santa Ana, and we would trade trucks, and then go back. And I was sitting down there at Avenue 200 on the south side of that little restaurant. I thought, who in the hell would live in this little town, you know? And I've been here since, you know, I've been in Tulare County since 84. God had given me little previews of what happened. I went back to where my mother hid out on a dirt road off of Fowler Avenue, off of Fancher Creek. It was a dirt road. At the end of the road, she'd hide out from my dad. And you know what that road's called today? The footpath is called Tulare Avenue. Right on that corner, there's a school. I'm bringing that up because at 2 years sober, I was working a jack-in-a-box. 2 years sober. Used to practice law. I was 2 years and 4 months sober. February the 20th, 1985. I got fired from jack-in-a-box and I was looking for a better box, a better job. So I got on my knees in the bathroom by myself. I said, "God, I'll do anything you want me to do. Anything. I don't know to go back to Sacramento, go to Florida, go to Fresno. I have no clue." Nothing happened for 20 minutes. 20 minutes later, I get a phone call from Lorene Valentino, Department of Ed in Visalia, asking me if I want to take a job to be a teacher. And I said, "I'm not a teacher." I didn't tell her I was on federal supervision, you know. But I said, I'm not a teacher. I don't have a teaching credential." She said, "You knew you applied for a different job and you weren't qualified for it. But I know you worked inside juvenile hall for 3 years, which I did, saving up money to go to law school. And I know that you worked in juvenile court. You know, I worked in families too, but I worked in juvenile court." He said, "You're the perfect person. I want to go over here and work with these people that are about be 18 and not finished high school from Sequoia. I went to go to Tulare Adult School. I went to go to Visalia." I went to meet her the next day, and she's not interviewed. "I already know I want to hire you. If that ain't God, I'll kiss somebody on the butt." It was a God thing. Offered a job on federal supervision, no teacher credential, never wanted to be a teacher. All my counselors in school said, "You should be a teacher. You love school." They don't make any money. I don't want to be a teacher. I want to be a lawyer. I want to be rich. I ended up being a teacher. I was going to do it for 1 year. After 3 years, when Schwartz wrote that letter and let me get reinstated to the floor bar. I flew back there, was offered two jobs. One as a prosecuting attorney in Titusville, next to Cape Canaveral. And the other one was in Holly Hill, next to Daytona Beach. That was 1988. I was still teaching, but was doing Easter vacation. I flew back. And I said, I've got two job offers. Can I get back with you? So I came back, and I prayed about it. And this is what I came up with. Why would I go practice law? One reason. One reason only. Make money. Where did I go wrong? Trying to make money. Why did I want to make money? To be happy. I love teaching. In the first 3 years, I got 323 people through the GED in a little tiny dinky class that was downtown at the Department of Ed. And then we went over to that church, you know, where they have the 210 Club, the Presbyterian Church, upstairs over in the corner right by Taylor's Hot Dog Stand. That was my classroom. They kept moving me around. Ended up in Montgomery Ward in the basement. And finally, Tulare Adult School, because we was getting ADA for Tulare Adult School, because my say was at the max. They transferred me over there, and I taught another 30 years. So I taught GED class for 33 years, have a wonderful pension, and have been sober all these years. My life changed when I realized that God loved me and that I could trust Him. Because it's in the book, what does it say? Trust God and clean house. Now, I went to Bible study. I used to have Bible study in my class. Of service, I'm with secretary of two different meetings, and I've been secretary before other meetings. And I also went to visit a girl on death row for over 6 years, every week, Christmas, Thanksgiving, all that, because I was single for 8 years. In one of my Bible studies at my house, one of the guys said, one guy was married, one guy was engaged, says, why don't we pray that you get a wife? And I said, nah, I don't think so. But they did. They prayed that I get a wife. And they said, well, tell us what you want a wife. I said, I want a wife that will pray with me, or a wife that loves dogs, and a wife that will go to the gym with me. And I met Maria at Evolution, so we worked out together for a while. We dated for a while, and we've been married, 11 and a half years. So God has answered every prayer. It's the miracles that happen to me in sobriety. There is not any doubt in my mind that God exists and that He loves me. And as much as I can surrender to His will, He'll put me exactly where I'm supposed to be. So my message to Chris, because you're the newcomer here today, Chris, is if you keep coming back and find a God of your understanding, not mine, but yours, this program will work for you. Read that book you have. Read the doctor's opinion, first 164 phase, and keep coming to meetings and get some phone numbers before you leave, and you have a very good chance. It says, rarely have we seen a person fail who thoroughly followed our path. Thank you for letting me share. God bless you all. Have a happy Valentine's Day.